The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our final final 2012 Space Show program. Great to be here. I'm your host, David Livingston, and we're going to have a great looking back and looking forward year in review type of program today. Let me run through our announcements real quick and then turn it over to Tom Olson. You can call us if you'd like to get in on the act, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring and be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can use email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you're not supposed to do anything commercial, no edits for YouTube or private websites, and no written transcripts, please. And then we do podcast, and Andrew over at gigadial.net handles all of that. You can find all of our podcasting information, the RSS URL on our website, and both of our newsletters. And you can find our podcast in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places. If you do have questions about that, let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that is our website, thespaceshow.com. So our comprehensive newsletter is there, and it is uploaded Sunday evening. All of the details of the week's program, the full guest bio, it's all there. And then if we have to change our programming during the week, this is where we do it first. So I advise you to stay in touch with the website newsletter from time to time just to make sure that you're current on everything. And there are times when we've had to change programs due to power outages and other things that have hit us quite unexpectedly. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen off of our website or easily download the programs. You can use the guest search tool, which is next to the social media buttons. And there you can do global searches like you could with Word or PowerPoint or Excel. Pull up all of the shows with your favorite keyword, like microgravity, or your favorite guest, like today's guest, Tom Olson, who's probably been on the show as many times as anybody else. You'll find all of the dates where Tom has been on and microgravity has been talked about. You can then pull those programs up off of our website via date, as that's how our search engine works. Please remember also that you'll see the 501c3 Support the Space Show button. We are ending our 2012 annual campaign today because the year is ending. But we do appreciate your support, all of you who have supported us and will be supporting us. It is your support that keeps the Space Show on the air. And we thank you for it. Again, if you're a federal taxpayer, you still get a tax deduction. And the same is true if you're a California payer. If you have any questions, go to onegiantleapfoundation.org, or you can go to thespaceshow.com or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, you can visit their website, www.swfound.org. And do remember that they are the sponsors for our webinar series, and hopefully we'll have many more of those. We've got many on the drawing board right now for 2013. Tom Olson is our guest today. He has been doing the annual Space Year in Review since almost the beginning of this program. And it's always great to have Tom on the show for this reason or for other reasons. And for those of you who are frequent and habitual listeners to The Space Show, you know who Tom is, so you really don't need me to introduce him, and I would introduce him if I could find where I put your bio, Tom. But given that I can't find it, Tom has been successfully running the New Space Business Plan competition, and he has turned it into a formidable business plan competition, not just in terms of BPCs around the country, but for space, specifically commercial space. And I found your bio. He's been a business systems engineer and analyst in communications, aerospace, and publishing. He has worked in investment analysis and operations capacity in financial services area. He's a serial entrepreneur. He helped found Exodus Group as a way to bridge the gap of understanding between entrepreneurial space tech startups and angel VC institutional investors, all looking for new opportunities. Before we did the business plan things at the New Space Conference, there was a Space Investment Summit, sort of the precursor of that. Tom was instrumental in that, and they were held around different parts of the United States, not always in Silicon Valley or California. And they were at the forefront of bringing investors, entrepreneurs, money, knowledge, expertise together to start everybody talking and networking. And currently he is an advisor and an investor in tech startups, and he has replaced his hemoglobin with space, and here he is today. You did one of those Star Trek transfusions to have space running through your system completely.
Is that what I did? How am I breathing?
Well, hot and heavy. Just mention the rocket and off you go, right?
That's right. That's right.
First of all, on a serious note, listeners, in 2012, Tom and I know of at least three monumental people that our industry lost. Neil Armstrong, of course. My personal good friend and space show friend and friend of the industry, Rita Anderson. And just a few days ago, Jesko von Puttkamer passed away. 50-year history with NASA, came over with von Braun, the Apollo period. Many footnotes in my doctoral dissertation belong to him, an award-winning person at NASA. So there might be more than the three, Tom, but we know for sure these three left us, and they're probably, you know, orbiting something out there. And they're missed. I certainly miss Rita phoning in and sending emails to the show. And life goes on, but these three people were really big in the space community, the new space community, the space tourism community, and they're missed. I don't know. You have anything to say? I mean, you knew most of them, too.
Sure, absolutely. I never got the chance to meet Neil Armstrong, much to my regret. And I got to know Rita, you know, through you, and we had some lively conversations in the past. I just met Jesko von Puttkamer just last year at ISDC in Huntsville. And that guy, he was amazing. He was just a wealth of stories. And he would go to the after party and stay up half the night with the kids, you know, just sitting on a little couch somewhere in a corner, just holding court. It was just great to watch. He used to do he was the one doing the daily reports from ISS.
Yeah.
Yeah. He must have done thousands of those, and he was the one doing them. And the only time he missed a day is, I guess, a year or so ago or two when he was went over to Europe or something. His laptop crashed. That was about the only time he didn't, you know, produce us. But von Braun personally hired that guy 50 years ago. 50 years he was with the agency. It was his only job, was working for NASA from the beginnings of you know, the Apollo program all the way to last week. That is a huge force of history who is going to be missed very much.
Life goes on.
It does.
Life goes on. So 2012, if you were rating it on a year of great, great space events and progress from 1 to 10, with 10 being excellent, where would you put us?
I would say maybe between 7 and 8. I think it's a pretty good year.
Why?
All sorts of neat stuff went on, despite the fact that the budget for commercial crew got cut in half or by a little bit more in favor of SLS and other things. We'll get into that in a little bit. Well, there was still major milestones reached and major successes despite the budget cut, most notable of which, of course, was the private commercial Dragon capsule, twice rendezvous with the ISS and docked with it, and then that second flight was actually the first formal paid contracted resupply mission, and that was huge. And the when the first one was captured, that was in late May of this year, and it happened during the first day of ISDC, which is in Washington this year, and literally it was in the middle of Charlie Bolden's keynote speech. While he was talking to the crowd there at ISDC, there's this huge screen in the background behind him, and it was a live video feed of the Dragon capsule approaching ISS, because it didn't just approach and just dock on its own. It's that's not the protocol for these things. They grab it with the robot arm.
So it preempted Bolden?
Well, you could look at it that way. I mean, it depends on whether you're a Charlie Bolden, NASA critic or not. I mean, you could also see it as, here's another great achievement in the private commercial sector that's happened today, and they're going to claim, kind of their own due credit for helping make that happen, which is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is he's there shilling for a lot of other things and talking about the standard space program kind of stuff, and here's a private capsule being captured by ISS, right in the middle of his speech. So I guess depending if you're you could spin it either way. I thought it was a great achievement regardless. And I thought it was just great timing.
It was great timing, and I think it was remarkable. They're actually the only private party that has ever even been allowed to get close to the station, let alone berth with it.
Well, the floodgates aren't going to open anytime soon, at least a certain precedent has been set in one company. Because you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get a launch license so you can launch something, out of the atmosphere. But there's also an even bigger set of hoops you have to jump through to bring something back. And not everybody understands this. And so now that door has been opened by a company, other companies are going to step through that sooner or later.
Absolutely. I assume that SpaceX will still have to dance through an enormous number of hoops.
Well, I guess there was a glitch or two on the second flight. I mean, obviously they hit their marks, and they did. They completed the mission that they were paid to complete. They brought they did their resupply, and more importantly, they brought a bunch of stuff back, scientific experiments, and a lot of other things.
You actually got a question in advance from your friend who is babysitting today and can't listen. About the ISS, about the SpaceX glitch. This is from Paul.
Okay.
And he says, Tom, given the reports that SpaceX experienced some glitches, there's that word again, mm-hmm. on its last flight to the ISS, and that it has pulled out of its arrangement with Stratolaunch, do you think that that is a sign that the company has bitten off a little more than it can chew?
Maybe with the Stratolaunch thing, they may have been stretching things just a little bit. After the series of glitches, they want to make sure their main customer is taken care of, and this is important. So I'm guessing that after the last flight, I mean, there was a couple of glitches. There was a couple of main glitches that happened during the launch phase, and of the Falcon itself. But then there was another. There were some little annoying problems, I guess, happened within the Dragon capsule itself. And they're just kind of they're sitting down with their customers and reassessing everything and doing some tweaking, and we'll see how that turns out. The next time they fly. Interesting aside, though, that I didn't realize. I knew they lost an engine, one of the engines in the launch phase. What I didn't know, and I have this source that's kind of connected in there and has seen knows some of these things, and he was telling me just the other night that apparently it wasn't just an engine failed and just it's not getting fuel and it's not firing. It's like the whole bell housing came off or something.
Yeah, it blew up.
It blew up. Well, it blew everything sideways. That thing was going into space, you know, it was getting up to like max Q and going past there and doing, you know, getting up to, you know, 10,000 miles an hour. But it was also moving sideways at the speed of sound when that happened.
Well, they claim that they have blast shields so that, you know, no single engine failure can take out the rest of the systems and redundancy and all of that. So apparently all of that was true, and it made it, and the primary mission was very successful.
We've had a long, long history of those kinds of things happening with multiple engine vehicles, even the Saturn V itself. I think it was Apollo 13 even. The center engine of the five main engines, the center engine actually cut out a little early. But they continued on to orbit, and they did just fine, of course, until all the other problems started happening.
Well, I think they're all made with blast shields and redundancy to keep going if one engine goes out.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, if you lose too many engines, then there's nothing you can do about it. But
yeah.
I think SpaceX says they can lose two engines. Maybe a caller will correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, too, I guess there's also, they're really, their main customer, of course, is NASA on this one, and so there was a certain kind of reliability threshold.
Right.
Couldn't drop below it. And so there was a piggyback payload on there.
Yeah, with Orbcomm. And,
yeah, they had to let that go.
And they got. But, you know, those are the terms of a secondary agreement, although I see that Orbcomm just renegotiated their remaining contract with SpaceX.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the terms of it. I just saw the headline. But I wouldn't be surprised if Orbcomm is going primary from this point forward.
Well, this is why they have insurance too. You know, these things happen.
not sure if they had insurance on the secondary payload, but they still got some use out of it. And it was supposed to be a demo flight, from what everything I've read said, and they secured an enormous amount of information from their test flight. So it wasn't what they wanted, but I understand it wasn't a total, you know, loss. As to Paul's question about having bit off more than they can chew, I have no inside information on SpaceX at all, listeners, but I've been saying for quite a while now that I think they have too many projects and are spread too thin. When you look at what they're doing with Grasshopper and Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, you know, their Red Mars program, and the Dragon capsule,
mm-hmm.
and getting everything ready for manned space flight on all of these.
Take on one more thing.
So my hunch is that it, and this is a different kind of rocket. It was going to be like the old style Falcon 5 that was on the initial, you know, drawing boards, but it was going to be a little different. And I think maybe they did just bite off more than they can chew, or it wasn't congruent. Or maybe the better word is symbiotic enough with what their overall activities are, that they figured it might end up being a distraction more than an asset or a plus.
That kind of resonates. It really it became a distraction for them. I mean, when they've got this thing really down to a science, and they've got, you know, like a 1 or 2 a month flight rate, even. They may sit down and reconsider some of those commands.
Yeah, at least get one thing going and declared operational.
Yeah, do really well with it.
You know, so, again, I have no inside information, but I would think that if they made it for those reasons, it was a very wise and prudent decision. And I believe these guys are tops in making business decisions, so that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, I have absolutely zero inside information here. So,
well, anyway, I think it's been a good year for the private sector, despite the cutting in half of the COTS funding and commercial crew. They did exceedingly well and met their milestones. In addition, we had a couple of big announcements from new companies that are starting up, want to either send people back to the moon or mine asteroids. Those were kind of huge.
Yeah,
big splash media events. I mean, you got one group in Space Resources that are put together by a consortium of people that have at least not just an interest in these things, but also very deep pockets. They attract the kind of skill set that they need. The most recent announcement by Golden Spike These are people that have a wealth of industry experience at their disposal. I don't know how deep their pockets are yet, but both projects are extremely ambitious.
Well, you're forgetting Mars One made an announcement, whether you're supportive of that or not, but they did that announcement in 2012.
Yeah.
So whether anyone is on the bandwagon for that, I can't tell you. But if you're looking for big splashy announcements, you'd have to put that in there with everyone else. I think what's remarkable, Tom, is that people, including really top professionals, because at least with Golden Spike and Planetary Resources, you really do have real business people, real scientists, real engineers,
mm-hmm.
you know, people totally grounded in reality, coming out with these plans. This is not the huff and puff rhetoric Kool-Aid crowd.
Yeah.
So clearly something must have evolved in 2012 to say that the timing is right. And I think that that's important for 2012. I think another thing that was important was the suborbital conference that was held down in Palo Alto. There were close to 400 people there this year.
Oh, great.
And I don't know if you've been to any of the suborbital conferences yet, but they're all largely people that want to fly something. And you know, scientists, engineers, people that have a budget through their university or their research center or their company, and they can't get a ride on a sounding rocket. And if they do, they're $2 million for the launch. And riding on a Virgin or an X-Core promised them at least the potential to do something for $100,000 or $200,000 and on a lot more frequent basis than what you can do with a sounding rocket through NASA. So, and then I followed the CubeSat industry very closely. I don't know if you've been following that, but God almighty, what a takeoff for this industry in 2012.
That's going crazy. It's just going all over the place. I just thought, I don't follow it as closely as you do, but I know there was a group of people that I know they signed a big deal to get some investment and do some things. A group I do know about, they're called NanoSatisfy, based in Germany, but they were a participant in the business plan competition this year. And they're working with Hoyt Davidson.
He was just on the show yesterday.
Yeah. Did he mention it?
I don't think he did. What?
I was in transit yesterday. Yeah.
What was the name of the project again?
NanoSatisfy is the name of the company. But they're doing custom stuff for CubeSats and NanoSats.
He mentioned NanoRacks for sure.
Well, NanoRacks, they're kind of a...
But not. We talked a lot about CubeSats, but he didn't mention by name NanoSatisfy.
Okay. All right. Interesting. But his company, they're the group that they're working with on capital formation and expansion.
They were at the business plan competition, as I recall.
Yeah, they did. They were an entry. They were a finalist.
They have actually come up as a comment or a subject on multiple space shuttle programs since the business plan competition. I should bring them on the air directly.
Yeah.
You have a note from Bev.
Okay.
What impact, Tom, if any, might 3D printing have on future manned spaceflight? And then it's signed Kichi from Oregon.
Okay.
So is there an inside joke we're supposed to know there with Kichi?
Kichi's the name of her cat.
So wait a minute. I got an email from a cat. I have another way of saying that, but I can't do that on air.
Exactly. Anyway,
even with eggnog and Happy New Year's around the corner, that one's over the top for me. So,
well, that's a great softball question. Thank you, Bev, for asking that.
Well, actually,
because 3D printing is already happening.
Yeah, it's not a softball question. It's huge.
Yeah, well, it's a huge, huge industry. It's growing greatly. But I've written about this. When I write, articles for space, space scalable types of technologies, and 3D printing is just growing by leaps and bounds. But a 3D printer, if it's not there already, it's on its way to the ISS.
I did not know that. So.
Yeah, this is already happening.
Where do they have room on the ISS for a 3D printer?
It won't be a very big one. I'll give you that. But
what will they use?
If you need to make an emergency part that just broke, and you can't wait from Earth to get it up there because maybe you know your CO2 recycler will die, and you will too. Then you can just make that replacement part right there on the fly, and plug it in and go.
You can't make biologics, right? We're only talking about hard things of metal.
Oh, that's in the pipeline as well.
Where you could make a medicine.
Medicine, or even someday a cloned organ.
Or a food replicator like Star Trek.
Well, that's that's where it's heading, but ultimately, I'm sure. But for right now, you can make a lot of interesting things out of just about any material. It's laid down. The depositing process, different types of depositing processes. It's always still almost like an aerosol, but sometimes they'll lay some material down and then kind of burn it in with a laser. And now they're making things that never been made before.
So remember the old Star Trek with Harry Mudd and all the models of the woman? You know, you know who Harry Mudd was on Star Trek? You know, and he had all the robotic women that they reprogrammed to drive him crazy?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming with 3D printers, you will someday have your own virtual family up there, that you can have it brings to mind Harry T. Mudd on Star Trek.
That's a little further afield from our annual discussion, but there are some major breakthroughs in robotics that have been going on, especially in Japan. They're just only fixated on this stuff.
Well, yeah, I get their things about their new changes in robots and what they can have them do. And I don't know if any of you saw this. This really hasn't got anything to do with space, but apparently there is a dog who has become famous because the dog lost all four of its paws due to frostbite, and they put bionic paws on the dog. I'm not kidding you. And somebody sent it to me knowing how much I like dogs, and it shows the dog with bionic paws strapped to each of its four legs running and playing with the family and everything just like normal. And otherwise, they would have probably had to put it to sleep. It wouldn't have had any lower parts of its legs or paws.
Well, commercial droids are just around the corner. This is the next big breakthrough that's coming through with increases in not only the bionics of it all, but of artificial intelligence plugged in, and they're making things that looking more and more humanoid all the time. And they expect another couple of years, maybe the first commercial robotic assistants will be made available, which will probably be a boon for people in our generation as we start aging, and we're going to need a little more help with things.
Aging. Tom,
our kids can't be. You know, our kids can't always be around.
When's the last time you looked in a mirror? Start aging. We're already on the way.
I don't recognize the guy in the mirror. I don't know who he is.
So. You have another caller, or a caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John Lamont.
Hi, John, and welcome to the show, and thank you for your support. I appreciate it very much.
You're talking about SpaceX, and of course I agree they definitely had a very successful year, but they also raised the issue of kind of their tendency to occasionally overreach. And one point I would think is this Falcon Heavy concept is another example of, you know, that's out there that initially I think they were talking almost like it would be the next year project, and now I think it's, I don't know where it slipped to. And I think that's another example of something that's, you know, that's way too early with the number of successful flights of the basic Falcon 9 to start seriously talking about and have people talking about that's an alternative to other projects and so forth like they've been. So what you thought about that?
If they have the resources and time to pull that off, that would be a huge boon for them. Here's the thing. Here's back to that old argument between public sector projects and these commercial private sector projects and the total development costs involved. I've been on the show before. We've already covered the fact that the Constellation program, they spent about $8 billion and really didn't have a lot to show for it. And the entire development cost, all the way through Falcon 9 to date, was only $800 million, one-tenth that. And you could argue that we got a lot more bang for the buck for that development program. If they didn't need a whole lot more development to get a Falcon 9 Heavy going, it really makes you question why people want to spend, you know, tens of billions of dollars building SLS and projects of that nature when for a lot less money you can buy two rides on a Falcon 9 Heavy and do one piece of on-orbit assembly and you got the job done. I mean, bang for the buck, it's going to be a huge, huge issue going forward. Although we're here on the space show, we're talking about space, we live and breathe this stuff. We don't live in a bubble. We live in a real world where there's a lot of people competing for a shrinking dollar pool, and we're in massive debt. We've got a lot of other things. There's a lot of political pressures from all over the place. And so you got to figure out where you can get done what you can get done for a lot less.
Yeah, but the point I'm saying is that what time frame do we really expect a Falcon Heavy to actually show up in reality? That's the thing.
Well, you know, I don't. I say still that it'll be canceled for financial reasons a year or two out.
The Falcon Heavy?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of SLS and John.
Well, I'm saying that Falcon Heavy is kind of the excuse for canceling SLS in so many people's mind. And I'm saying, but where's the Falcon Heavy? I thought it was supposed to be happening and a couple of years ago or whatever, and now it's not.
Well, isn't it supposed to fly at the end of this year or early the next year?
That was what I was hearing.
I mean 2013 and 2014, not 2012.
Yeah, it seems to me like that's really not seriously on the agenda in reality, other than maybe some paper studies or something.
I don't know. When I had Brian Mosdell on the show, he was talking about what they were doing to get the pads ready for Falcon Heavy and other, you know, other stuff going on, so I got the impression that it was on its development track, and you know, like most SpaceX projects, they slip a little bit. But
yeah.
And certainly for Elon's Mars plans, he needs the Heavy.
Definitely. Well, but also, isn't it going to incorporate technologies that have really never been? Well, I guess you might say the shuttle has sort of done this, but they're talking about a very good idea, actually, of sharing fuel between the three lower stages, right, that to actually use the two side boosters is also kind of a tanker for the middle core stage in order to give it a better launch, you know, the orbit capability, as I understand. Now, no other rocket has actually ever done that before, has it, other than if you want to think of the shuttle in a sense of this external fuel tank, but...
I don't know, Tom.
A good question. I'm not sure about the answer to that either. They're already doing interesting things with fuel just with those Merlin engines as it is. I don't know how much more you can push that to a different level. It still would also be just the most continuous number of engines strapped together that's ever been launched out of this country. I mean, a cluster of 9 engines is enough. Well, try 27.
Using the Russian design concept there.
Well, they try.
Didn't work too
really
well, did it?
A long, long time ago, and we know what happened to that.
But supposedly, maybe they've found ways to solve that problem, like this instance you described on the recent launch there, where the engine went bad, but they still it was able to make it to orbit and not destroy anything and substantively, and so that's a good sign. Well, I just thought I'd bring up that issue that it's interesting where the Falcon Heavy is and the actual development cycle, when do we expect it to fly?
Well, maybe someone listening will have more finite information about it and can call in and tell us.
Well, they may have to learn the lesson that Steve Jobs used to hammer at all his developers. Real artists ship. We'll see what ships.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing is the actual cost to actually build even a test example is going to be just slightly less than the cost of three basic Falcon 9s, because I mean that the you have the three first stages, which is going to be the biggest, most expensive part of a Falcon 9, right? And then you have a single upper stage, so that's going to be a pretty expensive test flight for them to fund with private money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, maybe you could, I guess if SLS were to have the faith that the David is so certain it will have, like maybe the NASA will give them development money to complete the project or something.
Well, this is kind of what happened in the past, though. I mean, when they were first developing, just all the way back to going on Falcon 1 when they were developing this, they had the military was willing to, you know, toss one and just to see how the thing would work. So they did get a little bootstrapping, you know, all the way up the line. It wasn't totally out of Elon's personal pocket every time they did this. So maybe they got somebody in the pipeline who's willing to take a chance on it. And it's going to help subsidize some of that development.
That'll be interesting. Well, I'll just wish you all a happy new year then. And
thank you. Same to you, John.
Same to you, John.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Tom, since so many of these new ventures that have been announced are basing at least part of their technology on the use of orbiting propellant depots, do you think that 2013 will see any real advances in the development of a depot, or will we just perfect the rhetoric a little bit better?
As always, you know, the truth is hard to discover on these things. I've been talking to a lot of people who are huge proponents of propellant depots, and just as many people who really aren't. It may get beyond a paper study. Hell, warp drive has gotten beyond a paper study this year. That's another big milestone.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Where did warp drive get beyond a paper study?
Well, this huge mathematical theory out there that actually, some really high-end physicists have known about for decades, about one way to possibly warp space-time to technically get us to other stars a lot faster than we would normally do. But they always thought until recently that the mass of exotic matter that you would need to drive one of these devices would be about the size of Jupiter. Well, this year, and he's a NASA guy. His name is Harold White. He wrote a paper.
What's his name?
I think it's Harold White. I'm not sure if that's his first name right.
Yeah, he's on the show Sunday, Friday with the group from Icarus Interstellar again.
Okay,
Harold Sonny White. Yeah, Harold Sonny White.
Yeah, he published his paper, and they've been doing some tweaking with the configuration of the toroidal segment that you have this exotic matter rotating in. And what it does, I guess, if you rotate, move this stuff fast enough in different magnetic fields or whatever, it distorts the fabric of space-time itself. And so it expands it behind you and compresses it in front of you, and the net result is that it's the space that's moving, not you. And so you don't. Those fundamental laws of relativity are not technically broken. You're still not going faster than light in normal space, but you're not really in normal space. You're in a warp bubble. And you're floating along as space-time itself moves underneath and around you.
Interesting.
And they say they could get at least the early equations look like you could get to, at least 10x relative speed.
Now, is this related to hyperdimensional physics?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh my God!
But the thing is, what got it off the paper and into the lab was the fact that the new calculation showed you only need a mass of exotic matter the size of the Voyager space probe.
That's a huge difference
from Jupiter. Yeah, and so now all of a sudden, now they're working out a deal to get some funding to get into the lab because they're working on an experiment to show proof of concept, and you're only doing it with like subatomic particles, in a room, to see if you can create this little micro bubble.
Well, that's our Friday space show.
Oh, wow!
Perfect timing, Tom.
Absolutely.
So we closed the year talking about this, and opened the new year talking about it
again, and with the guy who actually knows something. I'm the secondhand guy. I'm just passing it along.
Yeah, no, he will. He's one of three people on the show. Eric Davis, Richard Obusi, and Sonny White.
Yeah.
We'll go back to depots. What would it take to get it off a paper study?
A customer, like anything else. What do you need depots for? You're going somewhere to do something. The planetary resource people talk about depots, what they want to do. And actually, I'm interested in this because they want to find asteroids not only to have interesting resources that we want to, like, bring back, but they also want to find asteroids that have materials like carbonaceous material and water floating out there. Because what they want to do is they want to use that to make rocket fuels right there on site and just leave them there at that propellant depot so a future spacecraft can come back and collect, and, you know, and refuel there and keep on going. So basically you're just rock hopping. And you're making your fuel as you go. Next thing you know, you got people living, you know, in Saturn's orbit. So I could see where that could go. If there's the will to do it and there's, you know, some money to be made or however they want to do it. Absolutely. As far as, like, official government space programs go in the current stage of development, again, if you're going to build propellant depots either in orbit or on the moon, that assumes you have a program in place with an actual plan to, like, go somewhere and do something. Well, so far, all I've seen is the arguments back and forth for the virtues of SLS, but no one can convince me this thing really has a mission yet.
Well, in our budget lore of 2012, I don't know how else to describe it. I don't know that we're going to have many missions going forward because nobody can seem to agree to do anything. Speaking of which, are you concerned at all about possible cuts to NASA because of either sequestration actually happening and not really being resolved, or because of they actually start cutting and reducing spending and NASA takes hits? Do you see that as a 2013 eventuality? Does it concern you?
It does a little bit, because I think the wrong things always get cut in that regard. And, you know, when it's a political-driven system and not a mission-driven system, what you end up with is the guys with the most political clout tend to, or have the most, most people with political clout in your corner, you tend to keep your funding, and the people who don't have that good old, you know, an inside lobby kind of get the shaft. They're already talking about, there is a couple of kind of joint probe programs that NASA's going to be involved in 2016 and 2018 with the Europeans and some other people, and they've already talked about scaling those back. It's going to be... Science will take a bigger hit compared to SLS if sequestration happens. This is my concern. One of the things that NASA does well is really great science out there. The Curiosity rover, it was just an amazing event this year, too.
Well, would commercial...
We're still talking about the events of the year. Here's one. Real space science going on and some really exotic engineering. How they managed that landing thing was just unbelievable.
Well, you know, I've met a lot of the JPL people who did it, and several of them have been either on my show or on the John Batchelor segment that I do, which they call Hotel Mars. And, you know, to them, it's really hard for me to grasp this, but I've met them in person talking to them. It is matter-of-fact routine and not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
So for the outsider looking in who struggles to do 2 plus 2 and get 4, you know, these guys come off as master geniuses of the universe. And, you know, they take it in stride, and it's just, I can't tell you that they think it's routine, but they seem to know, you know, how to do it, and it's not a problem for them.
Well, but just, I mean, it's just, but the concept of it, you're sending something 300 million miles away. Months later, it comes down. Then you have this 7 minutes of sheer terror.
I know.
You can't control anything. This computer's doing it all. And they've got this thing hovering at the end of, you know, their rockets, and while they're lowering this thing on lanyards to the surface. That's just
and a lot
of complexity to manage.
And they, you know, I've talked to the people who did it, and either it's the biggest acting job ever, or they truly are so well rehearsed in it, and they're drilled in it so much, and they've practiced it and created it and done, you know, simulations with it that it really is like walking for you and me.
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing bunch of people.
But back to my original point, though, was that these are the people that tend to be more at risk
in budget cuts
when there's a budget crunch.
Yeah, I agree.
You think because Kay Bailey Hutchinson and Bill Nelson are already bitching that SLS wasn't getting enough.
And that
Charlie Bolden is dragging his feet on development.
So that means Commercial Crew is at risk with budget cuts because they seem to like SLS more than Commercial Crew.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Although, you know, in an act of boldness, they did double down and in their budget request for 2013 put $830 million for Commercial Crew back on the table. We'll see what happens.
Here's an email for you from our buddy Charles Pooley in Las Vegas. And Charles, I hope you go down to the Strip tonight and party like there is no tomorrow. Falcon Heavy may later or at outset use cross-feed of two strap-ons to core stage. By keeping center stage full, the performance is better. Not yet done by anyone, but it has been mentioned as a possible for future Delta IV. This information comes from SpaceX news feeds. Charles Pooley. Happy New Year, Charles. So that's
the hypothesis was correct.
That's an update on on Falcon Heavy.
Yeah.
Space advocacy in 2012. Any breakthroughs, anything you notice that may have transformed the advocacy network to being more powerful, more impactful, more useful, anything like that?
You know, and I'm an advocate myself, and there's a lot of arm waving this year, you know, in certain groups, and a lot of rethinking of policy positions and things like that. I know you and I are both in the Foundation.
Right.
We've had a lot of discussions going forward about which are the best battles to choose. I think the result is mixed for this year. I mean, obviously, with the success of Dragon and some of the other successes, it's easy to claim some sort of victory in that we've been advocating these kinds of policies for a long, long time, and they're finally coming to fruition. So there was cause for celebration there. A new initiative that's coming on the table next year is a piece of legislation that would actually commit the U.S. in particular to pursue space settlement as an official policy. And this is it's still in development. So you're not hearing a lot about it yet, but that's in the pipeline for next year. So I think the first big policy move next year will be something along those lines.
That Congress would make space settlement a focus of our space policy as a national space policy.
Yes, yes.
And that
would be mentioned that this is something that we're committed to doing.
And that would make NASA for the first time have a space policy focus is mandated by Congress, I take it.
Yeah.
I've been reading the emails, but I'm not following it that closely yet.
I've been a little bit. It's tweaked my interest. We'll see what's... it's like a thing on paper, you know, but at least that's important.
Before we take a break, 2012 may prove to be a monumental year for ITAR reform. Are you up on this?
I'm up on it a little bit, but we've been talking about that for a long time, I guess.
But it passed both houses.
Starting to build a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's gone to President Obama, and he has or says he will sign it. And these are reforms for satellite makers to make the U.S. Domestic satellite industry far more competitive by changing some of the munitions and ITAR requirements on satellites.
They took a huge, huge hit when ITAR was first being enforced in a big way. I mean, we were selling, our guys were selling stuff all over the world to everybody, and once ITAR kicked in, they lost a whole lot of customers because those customers couldn't buy from them anymore. It's just impossible.
Well, and they don't want to buy from us because why do they want to put up with all that crap?
Well, but they built their own companies from scratch. I mean, Italy in particular was a big customer, and they started building their own industries.
So it's part of the National Defense Act for 2013, fiscal year 2013. So it modernizes space-related language provisions within ITAR to be more competitive. I'm trying to look to see if I can find the specific things that it addresses, because I have a couple of press releases in front of me. They're not going into any of the specifics. They're just talking in general. But it's the Fiscal Year Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah. It gives the president the authority to remove satellites and related technologies from the U.S. munitions list.
Right.
Which is a significant step, and that strengthens the industry. And so that returns to the executive branch the authority to remove satellites and technologies from State Department-controlled.
And he says he'll sign it if it hasn't already been signed. So
right.
That both.
Well, the House passed it 9 days ago.
And the Senate has also passed it.
Yeah, so it's any second now.
Can't believe they got together on anything, but they did pass that. Everybody stay where you are. We're going to take our break, and we'll be back and continue to look at 2012 and ahead to 2013. Your calls are welcome. 1-866-687-7223. One of the things is, do you think there's been substantial progress? I know the rhetoric on human rating, Atlas or Delta or both. I can ask you that when we come back. Again, I know the rhetoric. They say yes, but rhetoric doesn't always match reality.
Well, really doesn't it?
We'll ask Tom about that when we get back. 3 minutes, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Year in Review program with Tom Olson, our last show for 2012, unless we experience Groundhog Day, and then we may be doing this show with you, Tom, indefinitely.
No!
Dr. Doug is with us from Southern California, and hi, Doug. Welcome back to the show. A very happy New Year to you, and what's on your mind with Tom Olson?
Yeah, happy New Year to you guys, too. I seem to recall that maybe back in the 90s, something like this, that, National Space Society or somebody actually was able to get a law passed basically stating that settlement was part of America's space policy. Do you guys remember anything?
Yeah, Stephen Wolf is the one who did that. I did lots of space shows years ago with Stephen. He is the father of that law, and it did become law, I think, during Reagan's era. And then, like what happens with so much in government, it is immediately crapped on in every year thereafter, so that it's probably now a non-entity of anything. But yes, they did have a space settlement policy, and Dr. Wolf did do that, and those programs are archived. You can pull them up. And I think it was in the Reagan period that he did it, Or was it the first Bush? I don't remember.
So it might still be officially laud, but just sort of forgotten about?
See, I don't know if it was, and Tom, maybe you can correct me, if it was a policy statement, you know, like every year we issue kind of like a space policy statement. I don't know if it has the force of law or if it is just a sort of a policy rhetoric, you know, a proclamation kind of thing. I'll see if I can find it. Maybe Tom, I know you know Stephen, and I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know Stephen. He and I have not discussed that topic.
I haven't talked to him in years. I don't know what's happened to him. Maybe he's listening today and he would call in. Do you remember what form this took?
No, I don't, actually. I mean, the last thing I remember that looked interesting was something involving a bill. I think it was passed in the early 90s that basically directed NASA to buy the ride whenever it could.
Here, I've got it. Steve Wolfe, and it's spelled W-O-L-F-E, spent over 5 years as a legislative aide for space policy to the late Congressman George Brown, Democrat of California, where he drafted the Space Settlement Act of 1988, contained in Public Law 100-685. Steve also served as executive director of the Congressional Space Caucus at that time and on the board of the National Space Society. And then it goes on, you know, he's Space Frontier Society and all of that. Well, Stephen has been, you can go get those archive shows. They're probably from the early years of the space show. But it did become, I guess, part of Public Law 100-685, and it's the Space Settlement Act of 1988, if anyone wants to Google that. But I believe that what is being circulated and talked about now goes much, much further than what Steve had talked about and what he wrote and what he did. But, apparently it was a law and not just a sort of a rhetoric policy statement.
Interesting. Tom, you know, I have an interest in space settlement, you know, ultimately, like I think most all of us do. And you sort of drop little hints about something that might be happening in terms of new activity in Congress in regards to making space settlement policy for NASA. Sometimes a little frustrated when things are sort of decided in private and then announced, and then politicians are sort of, it's set in political cement where they have any difficulty reversing, you know, their statement. And we didn't necessarily get much opportunity to have input. Is there any additional information that you're able to give? Because I'd like to be able to try to give some input, but I just don't. This is the first time I've heard about it.
Oh, I'm trying to find it now. If something was posted a couple of weeks ago about this. It's a piece of legislation. I may not actually get very far because there is a, because this thing has actually been driven by the people who want SLS, Bill Nelson and Kay Bailey Hutchinson. And so they want, along with SLS, a plan for permanent human settlement beyond LEO. And they want to encode that, enshrine that in a law of some kind, and mostly to, I guess, ensure that...
that we get there?
That they build the thing. And so from the advocacy standpoint, whether you wish that law well or ill depends on what you think on SLS.
Well, I'm in an interesting position because I think that we could achieve space settlement certainly with the SLS. I would see that pointing towards Mars, but I believe from my calculations, I think we could start a lunar base with commercially, not necessarily using the SLS rockets, and I don't necessarily see that these things are incompatible. I think we could actually do both. Let me give this example. You know, Golden Spike, they sure didn't use SLS to send people to the moon.
Of course,
they haven't sent
landers.
Yeah, but they haven't sent anyone to the moon yet.
Well, yeah, but in their architecture, by their calculations, they were able to get away with it by using existing launchers. That was sort of the whole point. So it begs the question as to whether perhaps, you know, we don't need an Altair-sized lander to be able to put an inflatable, for example, on the lunar surface as a beginning base, but whether smaller rockets could do that, especially if Falcon 9 successfully launches in a year and a half or so.
Tom?
Again, it's a matter of what are you going there for? What do you expect to accomplish? What's it going to cost? Who's going to pay for it? And again, if you're going to send stuff to the moon or to Mars or to anyone else, if Falcon 9 succeeds in its development of the Heavy, that's going to be a much cheaper ride than an SLS. And probably much more likely to be within the range of private commercial interests than a ride on SLS would be.
See, my approach would be a lunar cost approach, which is not strictly private. It's just like the current cost program. It's about three quarters NASA and one quarter private. And yet the end result is accessing lunar resources, which has benefit both for commercial as well as NASA. And I don't think we need an SLS to do that.
No, we probably do not. I mean, in fact, we were just going to mention this before we went to the break about the possible man rating of an Atlas V or a Delta IV.
Right.
Turns out, I was doing a little research, you know, during the break. Turns out that the big player pushing for that is actually ULA. They'd like to launch Atlas V and Delta IV from KSC. And so human rating is a big important deal for them.
Yeah, we were going to talk about that when we came back.
And now we are.
Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think we'll see much progress in 2013?
Well, ULA is looking for a new job to do. So I think they'll keep pushing it.
They say they're on target when George was on the show for 2014-2015.
Mm-hmm. I believe it.
And I believe that.
Are they getting funding to human rate the Atlas?
I'm still unclear on that, but I think the idea of having competitive launch vehicles is important. I hope there is some funding in it,
right.
You know, for them. But I honestly don't know. The guest yesterday, Hoyt Davidson, also talked about the value and importance of competition with commercial launchers, and I think that absolutely applies to human rating Atlas more so than Delta, from what I understand.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch this play out because ULA is still part of, like, you're like the old school.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
Cost plus contractor guys. And they're going to have to, like, change things around if they're going to start. When you talk about competition, okay, what are we doing? Because I still remember to this day that 30 minute phone call I got from Buzz Aldrin about 8 years ago, where I just basically gave him a good listening to. He was just talking so fast about all these ideas, and all I could do is to write everything down. But one of the things, the big question on his mind at the time was he wanted to do some commercialization with shuttle-derived heavy lift and do other things. And he said, well, how do you change the culture at ULA?
Well,
and I thought, the culture at any company is driven largely by... First, I guess your mission statement, but also your customers. They had one customer with a culture all its own. So where's the incentive? Change it from a cost plus to a more commercial competitive culture. Maybe they're getting that message now.
Well, wouldn't you consider Boeing CST-100 to have shown that a company that can make that transition?
Absolutely. I would argue for that as well. Because a lot of people in the new space community for years didn't think that any of these guys could turn things around and do that kind of development. But you know what? Even a super tanker can turn 180 degrees eventually.
Right.
Sooner or later, if you keep at it, it will turn around and change its course. So absolutely it's possible. And I was telling them at the time that they were going on and on about how Elon's going to do this and Armadillo's going to do that. And I'm going, don't count out guys like Boeing. If they really, really want to do it, right, they have the deep pockets and the facility to do make something else happen. And look at them. They're building the capsule all on their own with no command from anybody, just for their purposes. And they're continuing to develop it.
I personally don't think it's that difficult for them. I don't think it's that difficult for Boeing to add that program. And, yeah, they have a culture that's, you know, used to FAR sort of acquisition, but they didn't seem to have much of a problem doing the FT-100. So I think ULA could do it. And what's cool about ULA is they've got that that upper stage. And, boy, I would love to see... I know they're partnering with Mastin, or at least they gave an old upper stage to Mastin to do a cryogenic lander design.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, that could open up so much if that could move forward. I wish it could get some government funding.
Well, we'll see what kind of funding there is. I just want to see what happens in the current budget negotiation. And, you know, if it hits bottom after January 1.
Right. Well, let me step out here, but one final question as I hang up. Do you expect, Tom, any announcements regarding from NASA sort of officially heading towards an EML-2 station? All right? Thanks.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate the call. Tom?
I'm sorry. Yeah, that last bit kind of faded out.
Oh, EML-2 mission. EML-2 mission. Earth, Moon, Lagrange Point 2. Anything? There's been some talk about that recently.
There's been some talk about it. I don't know how far it's going to go. the engineers like it a lot. The orbital mechanics guys like it a lot. I don't know. I don't know how much traction it has with all the other groups that matter and have influence. And now you're adding something else into the mix. And everybody within, even though they're one big happy family, they all compete for funding and resources.
Well, I think,
and
you
so
know,
to add just one more thing to this.
To the degree it needs government funding, I just think that the uncertainty cloud, because of our economics and what's going on in Washington, even as you and I speak, and what all of this means for 2013, is a big issue. You know, a listener asked Coit Davidson yesterday, I think it was a woman from Seattle who emailed in a question and said, with all of this talk about raising taxes on the 1% or 2% and the rich people and others saying how it damages the economy and this, as an investment banker, what's his take on this? And he said that it definitely distracts from risk investments on the margins.
Mm-hmm.
So to the degree that space opportunities fall in the category of very risky investments on the margin because they're riskier than their terrestrial counterparts, and to the degree that the people interested in doing this are going to get lower returns because of higher tax rates and have less disposable money, and even depending on what they do with dividends and interest and other things, have less of that available, that it could very well impact risk investments on the margin. And how that would play out in space is unknown because they don't really know how much of space is invested in from people who are committed true believers and don't care about any of this stuff because this is in their blood and what they want to do versus, you know, the professional investor that looks at it compared to other opportunities, that category probably will go with other opportunities.
Well, yeah, the opportunity cost is going to be huge in a situation like that.
And so I think there's just so much for 2013 that is still unknown that it's hard to really, for me, to see how anyone can do more than talk about things like an EML-2 mission or this mission or that mission if it's going to require government funding or huge amounts of private capital.
Well, yeah. So what you're going to see is in this situation, and I think this is what he was leading up to right now, is that Some of those larger, riskier types of ventures are going to have a lot of trouble attracting capital, especially if you're doing it on the private side.
Email for you from the Alamo. This is from Dave Hook, one of our friends and frequent guest. And he says, I hope Tom and you touch on protection of information and communication systems for space systems during the show. Cyber warfare is the WMD of the 21st century and is rapidly impacting everything we do. Protecting space operations from cyber attacks and building in resiliency will have to be a consideration from the very beginning of mission concept development through end of mission and system retirements. Are you up on any of this, Tom? Any comments?
I've read a few things about it. It seems like it's a bigger concern of military space than it is private commercial or civilian space agency types of concern. That threat is real. But also, so is the threat of solar storms. There's huge. There've been our solar max hasn't even hit yet. We're going through a solar storm cycle that is supposed to peak sometime next year or early 2014, probably by the end of next year. And when some of those huge jets of plasma shoot out from the sun, that stuff will be 30 million miles wide by the time it hits the Earth's atmosphere. And we get lots of disruptions to communication systems simply because of that. While cyber warfare may be considered a threat, I think we have more natural problems like solar storms that we need to concern ourselves with. As we get more and more sophisticated in what we use low Earth orbit for and geosynchronous orbit for our communications and our internet systems and everything else that we do, putting a lot of big fat hardware up there they're trying to increase the bandwidth tremendously, and the more they increase that bandwidth, the more we become dependent on it, and we just have this insatiable appetite for data and info, more and more and more and more and more, more entertainment, more this, more that, and it's all going to be up there, and it's all going to be at risk from a single solar flare or even something else that could be triggered, an airburst of a nuclear device could also. The EM pulse could take out all sorts of things without any cyber attack, whatever. So, yeah, there's threats out there. The real question then becomes, what becomes the priority and what budgets are going to be used? I think the military is going to be the big driver of this. They got most of the money right now.
I wish I had access to someone at SpaceX who would tell us if when they're working their software with Dragon and everything else, if they have a cyber warfare awareness level and if they are taking steps to protect the integrity of their communications, or are they not focused on it at all and thinking it's really a job for the government? I know NASA is focused on it. Not too long ago, their codes for the ISS were hacked, and fortunately, they found out about it before any damage or anything could be done, but the ISS could have been controlled by the hacker before NASA found out about it. I think this was during the summer.
Yeah, that could have been mildly dangerous.
Uh-huh, and of course, we only found out about it a couple of months after NASA knew about it, so by the time they let it go public, it had been out there for a while. I am willing to bet that companies such as the satellite companies and SpaceX and probably Orbital and others that are doing communications within space to their spacecraft have a pretty high cyber warfare awareness and strategy in place. And I bet if they're doing business with any wing of the government, that's imposed on them by the government.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, I did shows with people in the junior officers in the Air Force who were being transferred to the Cyber Warfare Center, because apparently the Air Force has been made the keeper of all this. And as I recall, this is on the East Coast or in the Virginia, D.C. area or someplace on the East Coast, and there were a couple of women that were junior Air Force officers, and they were on the show for some space advocate thing that we were talking about. And they were en route to reporting to duty in the newly established cyber warfare unit. And their entire focus, they said, was on protecting space communications. So whether, you know, Virgin pays any attention to it and communicating with their suborbital vehicle or not, I can't tell you. But I bet if SpaceX were asked and it was something that they could answer, you know, and not be classified, that they would say they have a high cyber warfare awareness in their communications and programming.
I would think so. It's no doubt it's probably been mentioned. They probably had to sign reams of paperwork.
Well, and they probably have oversight.
With their customer, when they're package delivery to ISS, there's probably tons and tons of things that need to be signed off on, and one of those things, I'm sure, would involve security of communication.
David Hook, if you're still listening, and if you're not back at the Alamo, give us a call and tell us what you know about it. You have your babysitting friend Paul is back on the air with us. Paul is really a great guy, listeners, so I'm kind of poking at him, but he's really and truly a marvelous person with a wonderful sense of humor. He says, great show, Tom. Lately, I've read several opinion pieces by folks who are not especially impressed with the new crop of commercial orbital vehicles, since most of them are capsule designs rather than a shuttle like the Dream Chaser being used, which is the notable exception. How do we fight the mistaken perception that commercial vehicles are not taking us backward? PC.
Oh, well, good question. I wish I had the most definitive, smartest answer in the world that I could just put out there. Because it'd be flipped to say, well, capsules are easier to do, but it's just a tried-and-true engineering design, and this has been working for the Russians forever. I don't see it as a step backwards so much as I see it as a potentially a step forward again. Because back in the old days when we were building capsules, we were sending them to the moon. A capsule-centric kind of design strategy right now actually gives me more hope than a winged space plane does. You didn't need a winged space plane to land on the moon. It's probably impractical to send a winged space plane to Mars even because they don't have much of an atmosphere there. So those kinds of designs are probably just the most practical and economical way of getting things done. Otherwise, beyond that, if you want something else, you're going to do heavy lift launches and do some on-orbit assembly, and you'll build a much larger spacecraft of some kind, but it won't be designed to land anywhere. And so the question just becomes, how do you get back and forth where you want to go? What's the most efficient, cost-effective way of getting that done? Space planes are sexy. They look cool, and there are still some people that are really fixated on that single stage to orbit, using a space plane kind of thing. And there's going to be room for that in the future as that technology gets better and better developed. But is it the be-all and end-all over an overall space program? Of course not. You need all sorts of things.
Paul, you could drop the politically correct in your initials, PC, to all of these people and tell them that they're idiots and they need to go read basic aerospace engineering books or comic books, because a winged vehicle in space is useless. It has mass that is worthless. And because of the speeds coming back from the moon and even higher speeds coming back from Mars, a winged vehicle would be an absurdity. And the capsule is not just the most efficient design, it is really and truly the best design for doing things in space and coming back in space. The space shuttle had a totally different purpose for it and could not have gone beyond where the space station is. The people always said, why can't we take the space station to the moon? Well, it wasn't flight dynamic ready to go to the moon, to say the least. And if they could have done that, it would have been so hugely inefficient with landing gear that was really robust to take, you know, many, many different hard landings and wings and all of that kind of stuff, that it just, I mean, wouldn't have thought of doing that. So they really don't know aerospace engineering, aerodynamics, and flight dynamics, but the capsule is the best. The speeds coming back from the moon are significantly greater than orbital speeds from Mars, even more. And if you look at Orion, which is really a solar system capsule, whether it ever gets completed or not, you know, it's got many, many more features and more space in it than the other capsules. And you can put these together depending upon the mission, you know, that you have. And it's a much better way to go. People have talked about letting the space station become a solar system traveling vehicle. And you might look at that and say, oh, my God, you know, there's no aerodynamic design to that. But again, it's in space. And you're not talking about the same kind of designs as an airplane or a race car vehicle or something like that, whether the space station could be used like that. Bob Zimmerman wrote about that in his book, Leaving Earth, several years ago. And others have talked about that as well. So I'd tell your friends, and depending on how polite you want to be, to get themselves a basic education before they open their mouth. That's probably not going to make me any friends here, but what?
Well, spend less time on really solid science websites and less time at the Klingon Language Institute.
The Klingon
is where they need to go. But speaking of the shuttle, we're talking about events of the year. I know we're running short on time, but I do want to mention one of the things that happened this year. Of course, the last shuttle flight was near the end of 2011, and so the all the shuttles, I think, now are, they made a big display of this. They were flying across country back and forth and going off to all their final resting places.
Yeah, my son is over at Dulles Airport today with his girlfriend visiting Uber Hazy, and he sent me pictures. It's, I think Atlantis is... No, which one is at at the museum in Washington D.C.? That's Discovery, right?
I think that's Discovery.
Yeah, because Atlantis is at the Cape.
I'm Endeavor right now.
Well, Endeavor is L.A.
They're going to L.A.
Yeah, Endeavor's in L.A. and Atlantis is at Kennedy.
Yep.
And Enterprise went to New York.
New York.
And so Discovery is the one that he saw. He sent me pictures of it, and then the next set of pictures was Enola Gay. So I got the contrast of Space Shuttle B-29 over Japan.
Yeah.
So I wish I were there with him. That's all I can say. But, yeah, they're all in museums now. I wish they were all still on the launch pad, but no Buck Rogers.
Well, the other thing, too, I mean, we're just going to – there's a lot more challenges now. We're supposed to be a market-oriented kind of society, and we're becoming less like that all the time, but entrepreneurs continue to hang in there. And we did make some – you know, the entrepreneurial community had some great successes this year. And so there's hope in that regard. Because the other up-and-comer we got to watch out for, I think, we're not sitting on their hands either, is Russia. I was looking, just in researching some notes for today's show, I noticed that Russia is doing a whole bunch of upgrading and updating and announcing bold new plans. They're in the process of upgrading their current booster rocket for specifically to help support NASA manned missions to ISS. They say they're adjusting their RD-180 engine to do that. They've announced that they're launching a new, what they call a light-class carrier rocket for the beginning of next year. And that's from Russia's Aerospace Defense Force. They're using a Soyuz 2.1V with an MK-33-1 engine and be able to deliver a payload of up to 2.8 metric tons into low Earth orbit. So they said they may join the ExoMars project in Q1 of next year, which is in conjunction with the ESA, the European Space Agency. This was announced by Roscosmos. Few days ago, they're spending an additional, I think, roughly $7 billion a year for the next 10 years to for the next, now $10 billion a year for the next 7 years to do some major upgrades and improvements to their whole their program as a whole.
Well, they need to do something with their rockets because they have a huge failure rate going on.
They're having a huge failure rate going on. That's become a huge, huge political football there, too. And it's and they're in the kind of country where heads do literally roll. So how that all shakes out. But they're not daunted by this anyway. They've doubled down.
China for 2013, they're going gangbusters.
They're going gangbusters. And some of us are going to be there for the for next year's International Astronautical Congress.
Oh, the IAC is in China?
The IAC is in Beijing next year. So a bunch of us hope to go and take part. There'll be another investment and entrepreneurship committee series of presentations.
Well, I have my eyes on China and India both.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting because India, I was just reading this. This is, you may find this amusing. India is doing a lot more, as you say. They're growing space program. They've announced that they're including planning probes to Mars, and they want to launch their own astronauts. Well, this announcement upset the UK government. Apparently, I don't know where the UK is getting the money, but they were sending financial aid to India. And now the UK, which themselves, they see their own future in space. They want to increase their space spending. And they want to take part in manned space flight by making a contribution to an ESA service module design for the Orion space capsule. And so everybody's all pissed off over India saying, yes, we want to launch astronauts ourselves. We want to have a Mars probe mission, all these things. They're saying, well, we're cutting off your funding.
Well, didn't Thatcher cut all that off for the UK years ago when they were moving in the direction of human space flight and more space missions?
That was a long time ago. So
yeah, but she's the one who killed their space program that was trying to get developed, as I remember correctly.
They're feeling a little more emboldened today, and they're going back to it. And so maybe, but their economy is booming so much more now than it was 25 years ago that they can absorb that loss. I thought that was an interesting little tidbit, though.
And I also have my eyes on Brazil and Iran because they are launching satellites. And I don't know what to expect from North Korea now that they have successfully launched a three-stage rocket. May they get into the space arena with it, or will they focus entirely upon the military? Hard to know on that one, but I'm interested in seeing how that evolves in 2013.
NASA just produced a series of images using a special satellite that just made multiple scans of Earth at night. And so you had these great high-res imagery of all the lights on all over the world and where they're concentrated. And there's this in Asia, there's this one big, huge, dark spot where there's almost no light at all coming out, and that's North Korea. So I don't know how big a challenge they're going to be from because there were bits and pieces that fell into the ocean, and I just read this article. So they retrieved all this stuff and looked at what they were doing, and it looks like basically a spinoff from old, like Salyut-era technology that they're using to get this done. And while that may make Japan mildly nervous, I don't think the rest of the world needs to be a whole lot concerned over whatever ambitions they might have. They can't even turn the lights on at night.
Well, and I know they're short of food and things like that, but when you have a dictator in power who can direct everything and not be challenged, turning lights on for people or making sure they have enough food doesn't always cut it. They direct it to things the dictator wants. So I don't know. I mean, living on the West Coast and consistently hearing they can now reach the West Coast with their rockets makes one think a little bit. And whether any of that's really true or just rhetoric, I don't know. I'm the big skeptic about everything I hear these days. I don't even think we're falling off the cliff. I think we're just splattering. So we're already there.
I mean, we went off the cliff a long time ago.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the free fall's over with.
Yeah, we got, you know, forget all their little arguments over what tax is going to raise here and what spending is going to, and no spending is going to be cut much anyway. And so you're still looking at $17 trillion debt ceiling plus 200 some odd trillion of unfunded liabilities that no one knows how to pay for. We went off the cliff a long time ago.
Absolutely. So if you're in the market for a parachute, you're a little late.
Speaking of that.
Yeah, you're going skydiving?
No, but a guy named Bob Gardner did. That was a big event this year.
Yeah, we almost forgot him.
Bob Gardner, he broke an altitude record. He broke several records.
Uh-huh.
Back in, I think it was in September, early October. He broke several records, not the least of which was the sound barrier. He was clocked at doing like 1,600 something kilometers, or 1,300 and some odd kilometers an hour coming at one point in his free fall. And that's the equivalent of about Mach 1.24.
That's his Red Bull jump.
Yeah.
Which is, I hope everybody got a chance to watch it live, and if not,
I
on
did.
The rerun.
That was a major
oh, yeah.
Fun. That, was a,
that was a lot of fun. Very, very cool. Tom, 2013, more of the same like 2012, a banner year in one or two areas. You're on the edge of your chair waiting to see this or that unfold. What 2013, describe it.
I don't know. Well, I don't know how much I'm waiting to see unfold. I would like to see. I mean, I know we've been talking a couple years now at these shows about, you know, when is Virgin going to finally get it going. I am not on the edge of my seat, but I'm really hoping they get it going next year. I thought by the end of this year they would have had maybe their first passenger flight, or at least close to it,
or at least a powered test flight. But they still don't have an engine powered test.
Problem.
Yeah,
and it's.
So Virgin in 2013, I'm hoping they get it together too. Also,
well,
X-Corp.
Yeah, X-Corp too. But yeah, because of that problem is that while Virgin, you know, was developing this, that, and the other, and they're starting to do all their testing, and it all looked really good, I think they've lost the momentum now because of this. And that is important too when you're trying to build excitement and build a customer base. And
I have an issue for you before you can leave the show.
Okay.
And, you know, this is, in a way, to me, it is not at all surprising that it's happening, but also I think it's really revealing in many ways about the industry. So there is this fight going on about the spaceport in New Mexico over the expansion of the no liability laws. And now New Mexican members of their state legislature are saying that unless the legislature passes the liability for the parts suppliers and the others involved in this, other than just the main companies flying the vehicle, that the spaceport is going to turn into a desert weed fest of tumbleweed. And Virgin, they interviewed for the article I saw, George Whiteside, and he seemed to indicate they're looking at options for where else they may operate, because he said if Virgin ends up being the only person, the only company at the New Mexico spaceport, obviously it's not going to be commercially viable, and this is a big deal to all of us, the liability law, and New Mexico is dragging on this, and they may decide in New Mexico to not do these laws, and then for all practical purposes, the spaceport is down the tube. On the other hand, when you talk about granting liability exemption for everyone who has their hands and fingers in the pie on space tourism, what does that say to the guy who wants to spend his money as to how responsible and how safe these companies are going to be if they can't have any liability accrue to them for anything that they do or anything that they manufacture, or any way that they operate? To me, it is a double whammy of red flags all over the place for the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right about that. There are red flags out there. On the one side of it, you've got this young fledgling industry who just we managed 8 years ago to get through a regulatory regime that that regulates even to this day with a light touch for the precisely that argument that we didn't want to over-regulate right up front and put safety at the forefront and then increase the expenses so badly that no one could build anything, and we essentially strangle the baby in the crib. This is another aspect of that now.
Yeah, because the liability laws are only about 4 years old.
Yeah, and so this is going to... So you're going to see dire predictions on both sides of the argument. We have no liability, and then... You know,
now, see,
that raises red flags, but we have too much liability. We can't fly anything.
Yeah, and see, Texas and...
But you're going to see hyperbole on both sides of this.
Yeah, but see, New Mexico, these legislatures are saying, look, Oklahoma, Texas, Virginia, Florida, and California with a watered-down version mm-hmm. have passed some sort of liability law here. So part of the problem is not just... that the companies have more liability if they operate in the spare parts manufacturers and the parts manufacturers in New Mexico. It's that they can go to another spaceport that does offer them these protections so that New Mexico is no longer a competitive
yeah.
spaceport. And
that would be a huge loss for them because
$200 million
yeah. of state taxpayers' money in New Mexico. It's not exactly the richest state in the U.S.
Yeah, it's one of the poorest. So $200 million to New Mexico will hurt, whereas if the California legislature pissed away $200 million, everybody would go to sleep. you know, they probably do that in the shower every day in Sacramento, given, you know, the state of California.
Yeah.
But, you know, in 2013, if this is not resolved in the way the industry is talking about, we could watch the New Mexico spaceport go under.
Yeah, it would just revert back to the desert.
I think that would be an absolutely terrible thing to happen and a terrible omen for this industry, which is really working hard and trying really hard to get off the ground.
Yeah. Of course, you know, the counter arguments that people make, they have this as their basic premise, they have this idea that, you know, if we didn't have strict liability of some kind, then all these spacecraft would come falling out of the sky in flames and killing everybody on a weekly basis. And it's just...
Would they be...
Not so.
Yeah, would they end up being reckless or carefree? That's the, you know, the kind of the bottom line of it
yeah,
all.
Yeah, that's kind of the unspoken question.
And I don't think they would.
No, because the industry itself is too small and it's too fragile and... Everybody has to go the extra mile to make sure that everything's right and they don't hurt anybody. Right now, the regulatory regime really focuses on not so much protecting the passengers, the spaceflight participants, but rather the uninvolved public.
Yeah, the uninvolved third parties.
Yeah, that's all.
That's right where now. The law is focused on.
And we'd like to keep it that way for a while.
Well, actually, the passengers are known as participants, and they're part of the overall experiment.
Right.
So, what are we missing as we are over time? And
well, let's see what else is going on. We had a lunar eclipse this year, or solar eclipse. We had a transit of Venus. Which was kind of cool. And you're not going to get another one of those for 105 years.
Not only did we have great news with Mars Science Lab and Curiosity and the information we're learning about Mars, but we should not forget or omit incredible new pictures from Cassini that came in this year. Unbelievable. And then also Mercury Messenger. We have learned great new important things about the planet Mercury. Messenger is working like a delight.
And especially, you found a crater that looks like Mickey Mouse.
I didn't hear that. But.
Well, I saw this picture, and it does look like there's these three craters, and there's one big one, and then there's two smaller ones just in the right spot where the ears would be.
So we now have a face on Mercury?
Yeah, yeah. It's called Disney, obviously.
But, So maybe after Walt left Earth, he went to Mercury. Is that possible?
Who knows? who knows?
But Mercury's a great
cool
miss.
Thing I just found is that because we're always out there, the astronomers are out there. They're finding new extrasolar planets all the time now.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that. Yeah,
but they found. And they're really on the quest to find something more Earth-like in size. And I guess they finally found one recently. And it was right in our own backyard. They found an Earth-sized planet circling Alpha Centauri, which is our nearest neighbor.
We're making great progress in that area, too.
Unfortunately, that planet is not in the what they call the Goldilocks zone. It's way too close. It's closer than Mercury is at its orbit. That thing swings around its star in a matter of days, as opposed to years. So it probably is just this rock ball that has molten lava on the surface. But they found an Earth-sized planet circling another star. This is amazing, and that's only going to get more interesting.
If they keep Kepler going.
If they keep Kepler going, but there's other things going up there. My only concern is, there's so much promise with the James Webb telescope, but that keeps getting pushed back with cost overruns. And it makes you wonder whether this thing's ever going to really fly.
I don't know. You should put a call into Lori or Charlie and ask them.
Yeah, they're on my speed dial.
I can imagine.
We rock all the time. Absolutely.
Absolutely. anything you want to bring our attention to for 2013? There's going to be another business plan competition, I assume, right?
Yeah, there will be another business plan competition. We haven't officially announced it yet. We're still getting a few ducks in a row as far as various what the prizes are going to be and
that'll,
all that.
That'll be at New Space again.
That'll be at New Space again the end of July.
So,
we are doing something. I can talk about this. All right, brief. We've added a couple of features. We're going to do a market sector prizes, little ones like $5,000-$10,000 market sector prizes for various things. And so you may not and to qualify for one of those prizes, you may not even make the finalist list. That rule hasn't been set yet, but. We're going to give away a couple of two or three big checks and maybe a whole bunch of smaller ones.
Are you going to do boot camp again this year?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You're with us, right?
If you invite me.
Absolutely.
If you invite
me.
We
love your input on that thing.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
That's a great event, boot camp.
My input is the cynical critic who is outside the box from all of you guys. I rate most of the companies horrible. You guys at least look for silver linings in most of them. But it's grand fun, and I enjoy it, and the people are really fantastic and great, and the improvement on the competition this year, as I've said many, many times over, is 100-fold over. It was just amazing.
Well, we're hoping to keep at that altitude, if not climb a little higher next year.
Closing comments, pearls of wisdom?
If I can remember it right, I wanted to leave you guys with a quote I picked up the other night. It's easier to create the future than it is to predict it.
Who said that?
Walt Anderson.
Okay.
At his Welcome Back to the World party 2 nights ago. I won't call that absolutely profound, but I think it's important to remember that we're all in charge of our own destiny, one way or another. And
so that's what it means, huh?
Yeah.
But many of us create a future we don't like.
We do, but that's still easier than trying to predict it, which sometimes we try to do here with varying degrees of success.
I guess that's a good place to take off. I wish you and your family and all your friends and everyone a terrific... Oh, Exodus Consulting. Anything new with that for 2012 and 2013?
We're just keep on keeping on. We're still contracting to do the business plan competition. We've got a bunch of other work in the pipeline that I can't announce yet because I've got to wait till the ink's dry. But things are shaping up very, very well for us. So I'm happy the guy.
All right. My best to you for a Happy New Year celebration tonight.
And mine with you and yours.
And if you follow any of the football games, then I hope your team wins.
Well, I'll be in the future 3 hours ahead of you. So.
That's right. The ball will drop in Times Square 3 hours before it drops on television on ABC in Times Square for me here.
Yeah.
Take care of your cats. And I look forward to having you back on the Space Show with us as often as can be in 2013.
I'm looking forward to it, too. It's always a delight to be here.
So thank you. And listeners, it is the end of the year for all of us here at the Space Show. So very happy New Year for those of you that are planning on festivities tonight. Be safe. Be attentive. I'm not concerned about you guys being sane and sober and reasonable and all that. It's the other guy that you got to worry about. The non-space cadet out there. The space cadets know that they got to hang around to see the great things that are going to happen in 2013 and beyond. So keep it safe, keep it sane, have a very happy New Year with your friends and family and pets. And Friday, we're back with Icarus Interstellar, and we're going to be talking with the gentleman that Tom talked about a little while ago. Maybe warp drive is not so far away. And these are serious people, Richard Oversee, Eric Davis, and Sonny. This is not the pie-in-the-sky flakes trying to build flying saucers to do this and that and the other. So you, if all possible, you want to be with us for Friday. And then, again, we have our regular Sunday show, and we're back on our regular schedule. Thank you all for being with us. A very happy New Year from Tom and myself to you. And back again on Friday, 2013. By the way, there is a John Batchelor Hotel Mars segment Wednesday. You'll see that archived either Wednesday night or Thursday morning. Bye, all. Have a good celebration.